making sure that the budget is going to provide the services that Alaskans are expecting at the same time that we're not dipping too far into reserves.
Governor Palin sets priorities for this year's legislative session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 11th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, farmers take a new interest in cultivating fruit crops in Alaska.
When we announced that we were going to include fruit in this conference, we had so many people shown up that we've never seen before.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The massive stimulus package under debate in Washington is moving toward final passage in the U.S. Congress. Democratic leaders in the House and Senate announced today that they've reached common ground on their different versions. Exactly what that means for Alaska isn't yet known because the details are still vague. The state anticipates getting around $1 billion, but the House and Senate versions have substantial differences. One major difference is in infrastructure funding. The House bill includes about $240 million for Alaska's highways and bridge projects, while the Senate version runs $100 million less. The final bill is expected to be somewhere in between. Even as the details are hashed out, Alaska's Department of Transportation is already anticipating what projects it could tackle with the stimulus money. Alaska DOT Deputy Commissioner Frank Richards went to the White House today, delivering a message about what the state wants to do with the funds. Representatives from about 38 states attended the meeting, but Richards was one of only three people asked to present a local project highlighting the potential of stimulus money.
Our showcase project was our Dalton Highway project, and to improve the existing highways so that the freight and the foodstuffs and the pipe that are currently being hauled to Prudhoe Bay and the oil fields will be over a safe route.
Richard says DOT hopes to tackle two improvement projects on the Dalton in the first phase of stimulus funding for a total price tag of about $55 million. He says construction would start this summer and would employ 12 to 15 people for every $1 million spent. Richards says the project is seen as a prime example of work that can provide jobs and has the dual benefit of paving the way for eventual construction of a natural gas pipeline.
The secondary purpose will be that the construction and the massive amounts of freight that will be hauled over the Dalton Highway will be done on an improved, safer road network that has safe curves and better grades so that the construction of the natural gas pipeline will be done much more efficiently.
At the White House, Richards met with the new Transportation Secretary, Ray LaHood, and President Obama's Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel. He says it's unusual for someone from Alaska's DOT to meet a new Transportation Secretary so quickly. LaHood was confirmed in the post less than 3 weeks ago. Richards says the Secretary looked to the state representatives for direction.
Secretary LaHood has not been in the transportation arena before, but he came to the table and asked us all collectively a lot of questions. So it's good to be able to identify for him the issues that we see in transportation and the benefits, really, of the transportation infrastructure that we will be improving with this economic stimulus funding.
Governor Sarah Palin addressed the federal stimulus package and a range of other issues in an hour-long press conference that was open to any questions from reporters.
We are here and want to answer any of the questions that you all have.
It was Palin's first such encounter this legislative session. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Alaska reporters asked questions ranging from the state's response to the economic problems facing Western Alaska. The governor says the administration has helped with some deliveries, has opened programs to new recipients, has expanded the moose season for local hunters, and has more ideas in the works. They also want to know about the federal economic stimulus plan that's still working its way through Congress. She sees the federal plan as a supplement to the state budget and says the legislature will appropriate the money that comes from Washington, D.C. However, she wants to study the long-term effects of formula-driven spending.
Nothing is off the table. I mean, it would not be prudent of our state to come out of the chute not even knowing, and nobody knows exactly what's in that stimulus package, it sounds like, coming out of the chute saying that we would refuse some of the dollars.
She also gave her administration's priorities for this year's session. She wants to see an in-state gas project on its way to development. The goal is to bring together several different plans that are now circulating. She also wants to see the framework come together for a consolidated rail belt utility corporation that would bring together all the electrical supply facilities in the region. Right now, the administration's looking for some consensus with the local utilities.
I've been vetoing those rail belt energy funds now a couple of years, and we don't want to have to keep doing that. But we've had to do that because all these different utilities going in all these different directions to generate energy for, you know, fewer than 600,000 people has just not made sense. And we've said, you know, you'll get from the state these rail belt energy funds once you get a plan together. That still has not happened. So this is the way that we're facilitating that to finally happen.
And finally, she wants a budget that holds enough of the state's declining revenue for future years until oil prices begin to increase.
We have, of course, great challenges there with our budget right now and with the amendments that are coming up next week. We have a tremendous amount of work that we will be continuing making sure that the budget is going to provide the services that Alaskans are expecting at the same time that we're not dipping too far into reserves.
The governor's the center of a large assortment of issues. She promises the deadlines will be met. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Legislation aimed at fixing gaps in Alaska's foster care system was introduced today by two Anchorage Democrats. Representative Les Guerra and Senator Betty Davis have proposed bills that would work to help foster children as they are transitioning from state care into life on their own as young adults. On the House floor today, Representative Guerra said a staggering 40% of foster children in Alaska end up homeless at some point.
When our kids come out of our homes, they have a phone number for their parents. They can call up and say, I need help. I'm out of money this week. I need a place to stay this week. The day a kid comes out of foster care, they don't have a phone number to make that call. There's nobody they can say, hey, I'm about to get evicted. I don't have money for rent. Nobody to call.
Guerra says currently the state offers rent payment assistance for 1 month and two additional months of assisting with half of the rent. The bill proposes to lengthen that time and would also extend foster care and medical coverage if young adults wish to stay in the system until they are 21 instead of 18. Guerra says a group comprised of former foster care youth have formed an association called Facing Foster Care Alaska. They're organized and have well-defined ideas for helping maturing foster children find success as young adults.
One of the platform items is to say if a foster youth needs help for up to a year after coming out of foster care, so they don't end up homeless, they should get it. One of them says that since less than 10% of these youth end up going to college after coming out of foster care, we can do better and provide them college financial aid and job training aid so they can develop themselves into productive members of society instead of members of society that cost us.
Other proposed reforms would be to statutorily mandate monthly face-to-face visits between foster kids and their social workers. A federal report released last fall found that Alaska's Office of Children's Services had a dismal record in that respect, with 30% of foster children in OCS care only being visited every 8 months. Guerra says another item under the proposed law would ensure that children don't get bounced from school to school if they move to other foster homes. There would be funding to help keep them in one school so they can have better educational success. That would include help after high school.
Less than 10% of foster youth are able to go to college. This state does worse than every other state but one in providing financial aid for folks who can't afford college. You know, if you come through foster care, you should be able to go to college or get job training. And so we provide for full tuition assistance for foster youth who want job training or college education after high school.
Guerra says he knows there will be detractors who say Alaska can't afford the expense of helping these youth, but he says holding off on one $10 million road project would fund a generation of foster children's education and housing assistance, and he says it's a social expense savings in the long run.
Folks who don't like to sort of extend a handout will talk about how we should save money, but that money gets saved and then spent in jail. It gets saved and then spent in drug rehab. It gets saved and then spent in homeless shelters. And, you know, I'd rather spend my money getting people jobs, making the economy productive, and giving people opportunity in life. It's cheaper and it's more humane.
Senator Davis is the chair of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. In supporting the legislation, she said, as a retired social worker, she understands the need to close the gap in services for foster children aging out of the system. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iron Dog racers rest up and warm up at the halfway point in Nome.
We spent $10 on these neck warmers. That was the best $10 I ever spent in my life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Alaska-grown apples, blueberries, and even cherries may be available in your local grocery store in the not-too-distant future. The fruit-growing industry in the state is still in the startup stages, but interest in the field is expanding rapidly. A yearly agriculture conference that wrapped up today in Palmer included fruit growers for the first time. Stephen Brown with the university's Cooperative Extension Service organized the conference. He says more and more fruit growers are giving it a try in Alaska for a number of reasons.
One of them has to do with our climate has been getting milder, so we can grow fruit in places that we haven't done it before. For example, the apple industry is actually, it's small, but it's thriving. Here in Palmer, you can get some really excellent apples. So the university thought if we have an increasing number of fruit growers in Alaska, we need to be doing things to support them.
How would you gauge the interest in fruit growing in Alaska?
Well, I was really surprised. I have to admit that when we announced that we were going to include fruit in this conference, we had so many people shown up that we've never seen before that are interested in growing fruit. There's a lot of people with greenhouse operations, and a lot of young people I was really surprised to see here at this conference.
Are a lot of people thinking in terms of growing commercially or just for personal use?
Most of the people at the conference here today are thinking commercially. There's always been interest in fruits such as strawberries and rhubarb and things like that in Alaska, but this conference has really attracted the people that are interested in putting up the money to try commercial endeavors.
And what are the fruits that hold the most promise in the valley?
Well, that's a good question, because agriculture is still relatively new to Alaska, and especially fruit. We don't really know. Right now, we're pretty sure apples are a big one, strawberries, and the one that we're really excited about are blueberries. If we can get blueberries to go, that has a huge commercial promise. But for the meantime, I think apples are the big one.
What are the unique challenges of growing fruit in Alaska?
Well, obviously, the biggest challenge is the temperature. Second to the temperature are actually the cold winds. Because the cold wind dries the plants out, and a lot of people don't realize that we're actually in a subarctic desert or near desert here. And then the number three, probably the biggest threat of all, are moose.
And how long do you think it will be before you can buy Alaska-grown fruit in grocery stores here?
I think it will be quicker than most people think. If you drive up to the valley, you can already buy apples from local orchards. And these people are doing a very good job direct selling. Some of the community-supported agriculture people are probably selling things already. The problem with selling to the grocery stores is they need a steady source. Now, I will admit the grocery stores are good about buying Alaska. I have to give them a lot of credit for that. It's the fruit industry, I think, is still in its fledgling state in Alaska. So it's just a matter of getting more people involved, and that's what this conference is all about.
Stephen Brown is an agriculture specialist with UAF's Cooperative Extension Service based in Palmer. The The Palin administration is exempting seasonal ferry workers, road crews, and firefighters from its statewide hiring freeze. It's also clarified some other details of the freeze announced during the governor's State of the State address. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld filed this report.
Budget Director Karen Rehfeld says several state agencies are dependent on staffers who only work part of the year.
For example, in our Department of Transportation, where you have a lot of seasonal positions associated with construction projects like flaggers and construction assistants and those kinds of things that really during a very limited time with our short construction season are important to get those projects going. Another example would be the Marine Highway, where we bring on seasonal positions in the summer with the increased sailings and the visitors.
Fish and Game also hires a significant number of seasonal workers. The state hiring freeze has raised a lot of questions about promotions, transfers, and other personnel actions. The administration distributed documents last week explaining some of the details. They addressed the seasonal worker issue, as well as college interns and waivers. Rehfeld says departments can ask to bypass the freeze to fill the most necessary positions. So far, about half the approximately 30 waiver requests have been granted.
We have a significant revenue shortfall in the current year, and any savings that we can achieve with minimal impact on the service delivery will reduce the amount of draw we'll have to make at the end of the fiscal year. So it's a management tool, and there will be areas where we can use it, and there will be areas where we'll have to clearly fill a position so we can provide the service.
Rehfeld says about 550 full-time positions could be left open by the state hiring freeze. That includes about 240 in Anchorage, 175 in Juneau, 50 in Fairbanks, 8 in Ketchikan, and 3 in Sitka. Jobs in many smaller communities, such as Petersburg and Wrangell, are not expected to be affected. State Senator Kim Elton says the freeze could save a little money, but the Juneau Democrat says it's a poor way to manage the budget. He says some jobs are just too important to leave unfilled.
Does it make sense to not hire a child protective officer, bridge engineers, a fisheries biologist that is in charge of a multi-million-dollar fishery? Those kind of things can be destructive, can cost us an awful lot more in the long run.
The administration says 1,500 permanent full-time positions were vacant when the year started, but many of those are fully funded by the federal government, so leaving them vacant saves no state money. And Palin exempted jobs in public safety, pioneers homes, boarding schools, and some other programs. Rehfeld says that leaves the number of affected jobs at 550, and she says some of those positions might have been left open without the freeze. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
Athletes are thawing out as the Iron Dog snow machine race takes its day-and-a-half midway layover in Nome. KNOM's Paul Korchin has a race update.
The three lead teams pulled into town Tuesday afternoon within 1 hour of each other, setting up a tight race for the second 1,000-mile stretch to the finish line. Todd Minnick and Nick Olstad cruised into Nome first at 2:06 p.m. on their Polaris Dragon SP600s, preserving a lead they've maintained for most of the race so far. Minnick and Olstad have been at or near the front before, but they had to scratch from each of the past three races, due largely to mechanical troubles. Yet their Dragons looked solid on Tuesday, and Olstad said it's been a smooth first half.
Just kind of going our own pace, and seems to be working for us. We've only had the little windshield cracks from the very start, just a little alder hitting it, and they've been holding up really well.
Though temperatures have not plummeted as much as last year, Minnick indicated this year's race has not been a day at the beach.
It was almost 50 below at Caltech. I went to take my GPS out and it just shattered. So we spent $10 on these neck warmers. That was the best $10 I ever spent in my life.
This year's trail from Big Lake to Nome has been cold, clean, and hard packed. But there's snow in the forecast as Iron Doggers get set to depart on Thursday. And Minnick and Olstad said that's a concern for any lead team.
Well, as long as the weather's okay when we leave, it'll be all right. That's what we're hoping for. I don't want to break trail again like last year. That's hard on the machines.
Oh, yeah. It's always in the back of your mind. But you just got to hold them together and Hopefully they last.
Tyson Johnson and Tyler Ackelstad arrived into Nome 38 minutes behind Olstead and Minnick. Speaking through his wind guard, Ackelstad said exhaust troubles on the Norton Sound coast took a toll on their clock.
I think it's going to only be about probably a 2-3 minute fix. It's just it cost us a lot of time getting here. It slowed us down. Went from being able to run 100 mile an hour to not being able to go over about 55 to 60, so since Koyak, which kind of slowed our time down a bunch. It actually happened coming into Elam. And I blew it out coming on the road into Elam, and it's been like that since there. So if our plane would have been in White Mountain, yeah, we would have fixed it. But unfortunately, due to weather being cold, I don't think our planes made it out of Unicleet in time.
Despite that problem, Johnson says their Ski-Doo XP600s are performing efficiently.
They've been really good, especially in the conditions like this where we're going like half to three-quarter throttle. They do really well. We don't even need any extra fuel. And then you don't have that weight on the back all the time, so that's kind of nice.
Mark McKenna and Dusty Van Meter arrived 14 minutes after Johnson and Ackelstad. McKenna and Van Meter are both former champs, but they're racing together for the first time. McKenna said the partnership is working out well.
We're doing good together. We're cruising, having fun. No stress, no pressure. Had a little bit of a bad first day, but we've been going okay since, so we're just going to keep plugging away and see what happens. We're not getting bent out of shape. There's still a long way to go, and you're going to hit every team's going to have their bad day, so we had ours the first day, so it's all right.
Van Meter noted their Ski-Doos are behaving nicely, but Mother Nature does take a toll on the drivers.
Oh, yeah, this was a flawless machine. So far, so good. We haven't had any troubles. Runs great. Riding good. If we weren't so dang cold, we probably would have went to Caltag just because the sun was out and it was nice. And it would have saved us quite a bit of time because when we left in the morning, it was 40-some below and ice fog right on the river. So it was pretty bad.
The lead teams in Iron Dog 09 are set to blast out of the Gold Rush City on Thursday morning, aiming for the winner's circle in Fairbanks on Saturday. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
The state has issued a decision on lands proposed for transfer to the Denali Borough, and some contested acreage has been left out. The parcels were sought as part of the borough's municipal entitlement and require reclassification to change hands. The borough's wish list included property north of Glitter Gulch and along the Stampede Road. Monica Alvarez with the State Department of Natural Resources says the parcels were among several rejected for reclassification and transfer to the borough.
Certainly in the area around 8 Mile Lake, some portions of Nanana Canyon, some parts around Otto Lake where the classification was not changed.
Alvarez says the state's decisions to retain the land's current classification and state ownership were based on environmental concerns voiced by local people. Denali Citizens Council President Nancy Bale says organization members are generally happy with the state's decision, which she believes will protect the land from development.
When the borough would receive these lands, it was likely that they would be built on, partialed, sold. So at this point, we're really pleased that the state decided to keep those lands because they're both very significant, not only to the citizens of the borough, but to the national park, to be kept the way they are.
Bale says the Denali Citizens Council advocates for protection of 8 Mile Lake as part of a proposed state recreation area along the Stampede Road. That's something the Denali Borough also supports. Mayor Dave Talrico says state ownership is not a guarantee that lands like the 8 Mile Lake parcel will be protected.
Although they do have the ability for sure to set it aside and give it a designation, but I think right now they may give it a classification, but I don't know that that necessarily means that it'll end up with any type of management plan or designation. And there's definitely, you know, a lot of different things that can happen.
Talrico says it was just a couple years ago that the state was moving ahead with a plan to build a road on the Stampede Trail route right past 8 Mile Lake. The Denali Borough has appealed the state's decision on the reclassification and transfer, which leaves the borough about 10,000 acres short of its entitlement. Talrico says the borough can also select alternate parcels to complete its municipal entitlement. A range of parcels selected by the borough that were reclassified for transfer include property north of Nenana River Canyon along the Parks Highway in the Healy area and farther north near Anderson. the federal government has again selected Alaska Airlines as the essential air service carrier for Petersburg, Wrangell, Gustavus, Cordova, and Yakutat. The EAS program subsidizes the cost of daily flights to remote communities, and as KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports, that cost is going up.
The U.S. Department of Transportation announced the decision in an order from the Secretary's office on Monday. Alaska Airlines has been providing the essential air service in the Southeast for over 30 years and was the only applicant for the new two-year contract. The agency said there was lots of public comment from the five towns, all of which supported continued service from Alaska Airlines. The mayors of Petersburg and Cordova are quoted as calling the company's jet service critical. Alaska Airlines is planning the same level of service as it has been providing under its current federal contract, which expires at the end of April this year. However, the company has asked for a bigger subsidy, mainly because of fuel costs, according to Marianne Lindsay, manager of communications for Alaska Airlines.
We had to adjust a little bit this year, and it was based on last year. We lost some money due to fuel costs, the rising fuel prices. And so this year, when we put in our bid, we needed to account for that. But we did not. We don't make a profit in these markets, but we also don't want to be losing money in these markets. And so we put in a slight increase to cover the fuel costs and the kind of the uncertainty in of fuel right now for the airline.
The company is also projecting a 3.5% drop in revenue, according to the federal order, which was issued by Acting Assistant Secretary for Aviation Susan McDermott. McDermott called the company's request for a larger subsidy reasonable and acknowledged all the community's support. While granting the higher subsidy, McDermott went on to express concern that it is going up by nearly $2 million. She wrote, quote, "We encourage the communities and Alaska Airlines to work together to maximize use of the service awarded under this order and to reduce the subsidy support required for this service in the next selection cycle." The subsidy is aimed at making up the difference between the company's revenue on these runs and its costs. According to the federal order, that will mean an estimated annual subsidy of over $1.3 million for twice daily flights through Petersburg and Wrangell. That's out of a total cost of about $10.4 million. Meanwhile, service to Gustavus, Cordova, and Yakutat will be subsidized by an estimated $5.8 million a year. The airline's service to those three communities costs a total of just under $15 million, according to the agency. The airline's projected costs include a 5% profit. However, fuel prices affected that margin in the last contract, according to Lindsay.
Last year, we had, you know, we put in our bid and we, or the, you know, the years that included last year, and fuel prices took most of that away. So our hope is that we're getting a little bit and not bleeding, but not getting a lot. And so that's the best, accurate projection we have at this time. Where fuel prices go, we don't know.
Alaska Airlines' new essential air contract is good through the end of April 2011. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Paul Korchin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.